Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, if you look for them, the effects of racism in the United States are evident in news and media on a daily basis. When we aspire to the ideal of a post-racial society, we often think young people will lead the way. Dr. Robin DiAngelo says that hope is not borne out by research.
Research shows that by age 3 to 4, all children who grow up in this society know the racial order. I'm going to say this a little more bluntly. All children who grow up in this society by age 3 to 4 understand that it's better to be white. That is the message coming at all of us 24/7. And when we project this romanticized racial innocence onto children, we don't prepare them to resist that message.
Robin DiAngelo studies the ways our society is built to support and maintain racism. To change that dynamic, she says we must change how we discuss and take action against the racism that surrounds us. We're presenting the core of her talk here. You'll find the full version, including the Q&A, on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, UW professor Relina Joseph introduces Robin DiAngelo.
So I want to tell you a little bit about our speaker tonight, Dr. Robin DiAngelo. She is the third speaker of our 11-part, year-long discussion on privilege. Robin will talk with a topic that clearly resonates with a lot of people in this room because the talk sold out in 6 hours, which is amazing. I love telling my friends in other cities about this because the problem that they always have is not getting enough people to events. I said, no, we have the opposite problem. People want to come and talk about things like white fragility. Dr. DiAngelo, who received her PhD here at the University of Washington under Dr. James Banks in multicultural education, is, as you will soon see, a dynamic and provocative speaker who addresses the highly charged topic of what it means to be white in a society that proclaims race to be meaningless and yet we know is deeply divided and impacted by race. Speaking as a white person, DiAngelo clearly and compellingly takes her audience through an analysis of white socialization, what she calls white illiteracy. She describes how race shapes the lives of white people, explains what makes racism so hard for whites to see, and identifies common white racial patterns, and speaks back to popular white narratives that work to deny racism through forces like, for example, post-racialism. With remarkable skill, she helps participants to see the, quote, water that obscures how racism works in our daily lives, the miseducation about what racism actually is, ideologies such as individualism and colorblindness, defensiveness, and the tendency to protect rather than to expand on our worldviews. DiAngelo's scholarship and research in whiteness studies has been concerned with the challenges of an increasingly white teaching force and increasingly diverse student population. Do we have any K-12 educators in the room here? All right. Excellent. In addition to her academic work, DiAngelo has been a workplace diversity and racial justice consultant and trainer for over 20 years. In this capacity, she was appointed to co-design, develop, and deliver the Race and Social Justice Initiative for the City of Seattle. DiAngelo has numerous publications and just released her second book, What Does It Mean to Be White? Developing White Racial Literacy. Her previously co-authored book is entitled Is Everyone Really Equal? An Introduction to Social Justice Education. And that book received the Critics' Choice Award by the American Educational Studies Association. Her work on white fragility has also appeared in Alternet, on Salon, on NPR, in Color Lines, in Huffington Post, and the Good Men Project, among other places. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Robin DiAngelo.
I can't tell you how exciting this is. Thank you so much. As a student, you know, as a former student of the UW, it's pretty incredible to be up here in this position. So I want to start out by drawing your attention to the fact that I'm white. By the fact that I'm white, I was raised not to understand what that meant. And it's not a benign or innocent lack of understanding. It's a willful or kind of refusal to know or to understand. I'm very clear today, after about 20 years of struggle and practice and study that and mistake making, that I'm white, and that it means something, and that it shapes my worldview, it shapes my frame of reference, and it shapes my experience. And I move through the world from that position. And it's not just a universal human position or experience. It is most particularly a white experience in a society that is deeply separate and unequal by race. While I'm always coming from that position, I just want to be really clear and explicit that that's what I'm speaking to and from tonight. And when I'm talking about us and we, I'm talking to the majority of most audiences I'm in front of, which are other white people. Now, people of color have to understand my reality pretty much from the very beginning in a way that I'm sorry to say I don't have to understand yours. I can be seen as qualified to lead a major institution and not have any understanding whatsoever of the experience or reality of people of color. That's part of what it means to be white in this society. For people of color, what can be maybe useful about a talk like this is that I'm going to name and admit to things that white people rarely ever name or admit to. And that can help a little bit with the crazy making, hopefully. All right, but I do want to acknowledge that although I have my own way of articulating this, and as an insider to whiteness, I have an understanding of it that people of color really can't have. They have an understanding of it that I will never have. And I want to acknowledge all the incredible, brilliant, patient mentors of color that have stood with me and not given up on me for many, many years. Right? Okay, so white fragility is the inability to tolerate racial stress. Right? Racial stress is triggered when our positions, perspectives, or advantages are challenged. And white fragility functions to block that challenge and regain our racial equilibrium. So white people move through an environment which reflects and affirms and insulates us from that stress. And we haven't had to build our stamina. It's a very rare experience to be thrown off balance racially. And that kind of fragility functions to stop that threat, if you will, and regain that equilibrium. So in order to kind of get us to the place where this is kind of where we're at, we need to start by talking about socialization, right? So by every measure across every institution in this country, there's racial disparity. And I don't spend time trying to prove that. I think the empirical evidence comes in every day. And I think on some level, we all know that, right? Despite ideologies like meritocracy and individualism, I think we all understand our society is deeply unequal by race across every institution and across every measure. It continues to beautifully reproduce racial inequity. Right. So at the same time, what is today's dominant racial narrative? Well, I'm a former professor of education. I used to teach in a large teacher education department or program in Western Massachusetts. We put out hundreds of teachers every year, and the program was 98% white. So it was rare for me to ever have a student of color in any class. And we were 10 miles from a city that was 57% black and Latino. And on the first day of class, I would ask my students, write me an anonymous reflection on a couple of key questions related to your racial socialization. How racially diverse were your schools and neighborhoods growing up? What messages have you gotten across your life about race? And what are some of the ways in which your life has been shaped by your race? And what I'm going to show you is representative of the hundreds of these anonymous reflections that I have from our future teachers in their junior and senior years of university, soon to be certified as highly educated, and go forth and teach in those schools in Springfield. My neighborhood growing up was not racially diverse at all. Every family in my neighborhood was also Caucasian. Throughout my time in school, I have continually been taught that skin does not matter. Is that familiar to you? All right, that's today's dominant racial narrative. This is a post-civil rights narrative, not a pre-civil rights narrative. But this is the younger generation, right? The one that when my generation dies off, there'll be no more racism. I'm going to make a case that this is what we call new racism. It's certainly adapted. It's changed. It still functions to produce the same inequitable outcomes, right? So the question that drives my work, as was named in the introduction, is basically how do we pull this off? How do my students sit in such explicit segregation and make claims like this? So in order to kind of get us to understanding white fragility, we have to understand how we come to be able to pull this off, right? Why this is so familiar to so many. And I like to say, especially when I'm in this setting, which is the University of Washington, that I was an A student, which meant I always sat in the front row. And I would have written about 3 pages on that question if I was in that class and got asked. But the essential message in that essay would have been this. Right? I think it's worth noting that this is all this student could be bothered to write on the topic. I would have written more, but I still would have basically said that. So try to reach for, particularly if you're white, try to reach for where do I recognize that in myself, right? I'm going to show you things that are maybe a little more bald or less sophisticated than some of us might express, but hopefully you will still recognize it. Oh, and I should add, trust me, this student has an opinion on racism, okay? I've never met a white person without an opinion on racism, and yet this is often the foundation from which we you know, with so much confidence, trot forth those opinions. So racism is a system, right? And it works on multiple levels across the society, and it results in an unequal distribution of resources between white people overall and people of color overall, with white people as the beneficiaries of that distribution. Right? That is not a mainstream definition. Mainstream definition of racism is just racial prejudice. A social scientific understanding includes the weight of historical and institutional power. And at the same time, what is the dominant conceptualization of racism? Well, certainly not that it's a system. Post-civil rights, racism adapted to the challenges by becoming an either-or proposition, right? To be a good moral person and to be complicit with racism became mutually exclusive, right? And I think this is the root of virtually all white defensiveness on this topic. Have any of you noticed any white defensiveness on this topic? All right, just checking. So we know how to fill this in, right? So our racist is, they're bad, right? They're bad people, and they're ignorant and bigoted and prejudiced, mean-spirited, old, Southern. They drive pickup trucks because we got to get a little classism in there, and they live in Snohomish, okay? Or Fife. Okay. And are not racist is good, right? The educated, progressive, open-minded, well-intended, young, northern, we shop at PCC. Not Whole Foods because that's a corporation. We drive Priuses, and we're moving to Portland really soon. Okay, so this is just so incredibly effective at making it virtually impossible to talk to white people about racism as a system, as the water we're all swimming in, as an inevitable and unavoidable internalized dynamic for us, right? So what we need to do is just get rid of this, right? It is not about good and bad people. Right? It's not about conscious intention. So this kind of either-or, good-bad, very simple idea about it only operating on an individual basis manifests in a range of narratives. Okay? And I have this really weird job for a living. I walk into rooms every day that are primarily white, and I start not only talking about racism, but pushing white people to connect to it. And in doing this, I hear the same narratives over and over. And as I listen, this image formed in my mind, right, of like a pier or a dock. And what it signifies for me is how superficial or surface these narratives are, right? It's like, because when you look at that dock, it looks like it's just floating on the water, right? So let's see if we don't recognize any of these dominant post-civil right narratives. I was taught to treat everyone the same. Anybody ever hear that one? I think that's probably the number one. So you ready? No, you weren't. Okay, not one single person in this room was taught to treat everyone the same. Now, how can I say that when I don't know you? Because you actually can't do that. It's not humanly possible. Human beings are not objective, cannot be objective. We can only understand the world through the cultural filter we've been socialized to interpret experience through. So you can be told, I could lecture you for years, but you can't actually learn it in the sense of being able to do it any more than you can learn not to judge. So when a white person says this to me in a conversation about racism, I know that they think they're telling me what? That they're not racist, right? What they're actually telling me is that they don't understand socialization, they don't have a basic understanding of culture, and they're not particularly self-aware. Oh, and I and I got to shout out to the people that come in the room. Are you convinced when we say these things? All right. White folks, listen up. Okay. I see people as individuals. I don't care if you're pink, purple, polka dotted. It's in the past. Everyone struggles. You know, if you work hard. My parents weren't racist. That's why I'm not racist. My parents were racist. That's why I'm not racist. It doesn't matter what comes first. What comes second must be, I'm not racist. Right? So-and-so just happened to be black, but has nothing to do with the tension the entire office feels around her. Okay, this is one that I would really ask you to remove from your vocabulary. In conversations about race or racism, anything that begins with just happened to be or regardless of, basically what you're doing in that move is positioning some kind of universal experience or reality, and you can't do that. There isn't a universal experience or reality. I might not know what race has to do with that conflict, but I have to be willing to grapple with its influence on the way I'm perceiving and interacting across race. Okay, so these are colorblind, right? These are all colorblind, and I'm gonna assume most people in the room understand that while it seemed like a good strategy, it's actually functioned to just deny that anything's going on, right? To deny racism, to deny inequality, and to pretend as if these things don't matter and we don't notice them, right? So if we're a little more sophisticated, we don't probably say this. What do we say? What do these PC shopping, cloth bag bringing, Prius driving liberals say? All right, let's see. I actually love making fun of white progressives because I am one. I really did believe when I started this work that my qualifications were that I was a vegetarian. Was I in for a huge learning. I actually think white progressives are the hardest. Yes. Because the degree to which we think we're good to go because we went on a trip to Costa Rica for a week. We're going to put all our energy into trying to convince you of that too. And none of our energy in what we need to be doing for the rest of our lives in this water is deep reflection, struggle, and practice, right? So we say things like this. Oh, I work in a very diverse environment. Yeah. I have people of color in my family. Oh, I'm not racist. I used to live in New York. And I'm like, you're kidding. You used to walk by people of color? And you didn't lose your... You're amazing. Okay. All right. I actually have heard I used to live in New York as evidence, okay? Used interchangeably with I used to live in Hawaii, because there's no racism in Hawaii. And I used to be in the military. Apparently, there's no racism in the military. Okay. So how many of you have heard some version of these in a conversation with a white person on racism? Okay, look at that. Just like basically everybody, because these are the dominant narratives. So let's do a little discourse analysis, right? Let's do what we so rarely do, which is interrogate this and problematize it a little bit. So a white person who invokes one of these narratives is basically giving you their evidence, right? This is my evidence, and in my mind, what is this my evidence of? What am I trying to make sure you understand? I'm not racist, okay? That's my evidence. So if that's my evidence, what's my definition of racism? And this is actually a really important thing to be able to do, both with other people, but with yourself too, right? Really think deeply about what you're saying and what you're drawing from. Because being able to do this has really helped me figure out, okay, so then now what do I need to speak to? How would I help move this person forward, right? So what I think the definition that this is rests on is a racist is a person who cannot tolerate the sight of people of color, has conscious dislike, and apparently couldn't walk by them in New York without having, moving out of New York, right? Couldn't work three cubicles down from a person of color, right? Just couldn't be near them. Am I wrong? Can you see any other meaning that this could have if that's your evidence? Okay. So on one level, I assure you that even a conscious, avowed racist, and they're out there, right? White nationalists, you know, someone who absolutely does openly avow white supremacy, trust me, they could live in New York. And they could work near people of color, and they could actually have people of color in their family. So just on that basis alone, it's not good evidence. But it also is just a really limited understanding of what racism is, right? It's just reduced to conscious dislike, intentional conscious dislike. And since I'm not aware of any of that, I'm free of it and couldn't possibly be complicit with it. So this person doesn't understand institutional racism. This person doesn't understand the power of an implicit bias, which actually drives much more of our behavior than anything in our conscious mind, right? I do want to talk about how people of color in my family for just a moment. While I think one of the really most powerful interruptions to the ways that we get socialized as white people is to build authentic, sustained cross-racial relationships, that is not going to free the relationship of racism, right? There will still be racial dynamics you struggle with in your relationship because we were raised different, we have different experiences, we receive different messages, people are responding to us differently when we're together versus when we're apart. You will grapple with it in the relationship. So let me ask the folks of color in the room, do you have relationships with white people that have some racism still in the relationship?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So we seem to be able to do this with gender, right? So how many, and I'm going to use cisgender terms, however you identify around these gender terms, how many of the women in the room have a primary partnership with someone identified as male? Okay, so the moment he fell in love with you, his sexism vanished, correct? It didn't? How could he possibly have any sexism? He loves you. Okay, and if you're not sure about your current partner, just think about your ex. All right, do you get my point? You will struggle. Of course you love each other. Fond regard does not remove our deep socialization. And we would never say, oh yeah, my marriage or my partnership is free of all gender dynamics, right? So, but when it comes to race, we consistently do this, position it as inoperative if there's fond regard, okay? Children are so much more open. This is a very cherished one, too. I'm sure children are born racially open, but the research shows that by age 3 to 4, all children who grow up in this society know the racial order. I'm going to say this a little more bluntly. All children who grow up in this society by age 3 to 4 understand that it's better to be white. That is the message coming at all of us 24/7. And when we project this romanticized racial innocence onto children, we don't prepare them to resist that message. Okay. I already know all this. Okay. What I will just say about that is, again, you may think you're telling someone that you're good to go, but the arrogance in this is really, really problematic. I will spend the rest of my life challenging my socialization, and I will never be free of it. So that's a very problematic position. We don't like how white our neighborhood is, but we had to move here for the schools. So these are the more progressive white narratives, right? And all of these, both the colorblind on the previous slide and these, rest on a foundation, right? And in order to understand how they function to keep racism going, we've got to understand what is that foundation. And it's a different foundation than we had pre-civil rights. So that's what I want to map out. And I want to have you just think to yourselves for just a moment, right? Think about your neighborhoods. How racially diverse was your neighborhood growing up? And what messages do we get about race from our neighborhoods? And if you are like most white people, those of you who are white in this country, your answer is most likely, I grew up in a primarily white neighborhood. And I like to put that a little more directly. You probably grew up, you're most likely, if you're white, you most likely grew up in racial segregation. Most white people do grow up in racial segregation, segregation that we choose, that is the result of decades of policies and procedures, and that we call good. Just think about the power of that message. Good, safe, right? The message of it's normal to live apart. It's natural to live apart. It's maybe, on some level, even right to live apart. But certainly no one's conveying to us that there's a problem, right? We get very, very powerful messages from living in segregation. Segregation is not neutral. It is not inactive. It's living. It's socializing us in every moment. But again, I was taught to see race as only happening if people of color were in the picture. If they're not in the picture, there's no race happening. And we have to start to understand the power of segregation. And then think about the first time you had a teacher of the same race or races, if you're multiracial, as you, and how often that happened. And the first time you had a teacher of a different race than you, how often that happened, and why that might be important. And if you're like most people who grew up in this country, your answer is, if you're white from the time you began and you could get through graduate school, rarely if ever not being racially affirmed at the front of that room. And if you're a person of color, your answer is probably, rarely if ever did I see myself reflected in the front of that room. Our teachers are our role models. They're the holders of knowledge and authority. They shape our worldviews. They decide who's smart, who's well-behaved, who's deserving, who belongs where. The teaching force is getting more, not less, white in this country. We are at 83 to 93% white nationwide, and our schools are almost back to pre-Brown versus segregation, Brown versus... There you go. Levels of segregation. And that white teaching force is not any more or less racist than any other group of white people who grew up in this water, but they're in a very powerful position. They answer these questions very similarly. They grew up in segregation. They've only ever had white teachers. So where do we get our understanding of people of color? From the most problematic sources. Right? Media, jokes, omission, television, warnings. But now we're in that position to determine, again, who goes where. And we have the school-to-prison pipeline. And we have empirical evidence that those determinations are made within equity. racial inequity. Seattle Public Schools are currently under federal investigation for racial disparity in their outcomes. Right. So a friend of mine puts it like this: pretty much all of us have been taught by white people, who've 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 been taught by white people, using textbooks written for, by, and about white people. You getting the weight of that white worldview? Right? It's not about whether I'm friendly. Right? It's deeply internalized. And I have an image that I like to show that I think it's just one image, but it just so nicely captures this dynamic. And keep in mind that that white teaching force is only one thread in one institution. We didn't talk about testing, tracking, funding, curriculum, location, etc. So just to get a sense of what it means to say that racism is institutionalized. So this is the this year's College Jeopardy Champion Playoffs. Those are our best and our brightest. Those are college students. and that is the board at the end of the Grand Champion round. So we can see there was one category, not one of them touched. Clearly the hardest. Nobody wanted to lose, and nobody was going to risk it.
The image Dr. D'Angelo projected here was of a panel of white student contestants. The Untouched Jeopardy column was African American history.
Yeah, and I don't feel I can do justice to actually the depth of what this means. I really don't believe that we can understand racism or how we came to be in this moment if we cannot trace the past into the present, if we don't know our history. And this is my history. This is the history of our groups in struggle. You know what's going to be under that category, right? Civil War and civil rights, because that's their history, right? And that happened in a vacuum, I guess. No, that's our history. And it's the history of hundreds and hundreds of years of this country. And yet, I can guarantee you those college students have opinions on racism. I just got to say it. All right. So Joe Fagan is a sociologist who talks about the white racial frame, and it's just kind of the theoretical articulation of those pillars, right? So I the visual image of the pillars that are propping up the dock. So he talks about it as the deeply internalized framework through which whites make racial meaning, and it includes images, interpretations, perceptions, etc., that position whites as superior and that are passed down and reinforced throughout society. And so in everything I've done so far, I've tried to help us see a little bit of that frame, right? Because when it's your frame, it's really hard to see. It's like a fish in water that's swimming with a current. So I'm going to start showing you some images that I just think capture the white racial frame. This is on a science website right now. Is this the scientifically perfect face? Wow, right? And remember that part of the definition of the white racial frame is, and it keeps it in circulation, right, and passed down across time and throughout society. This invokes very old racist science, right? That this is some kind of natural thing, right? This is an ad I saw on a Delta flight last year in the In-Flight magazine, and the first thing that struck me was, wow, look at the racial order in that ad. It's so clear. You have your white women in the front with red hair wearing green. You have your Asian women in the middle, literally wearing yellow, and your black women in the back wearing brown. But also notice this is an ad for the purse. Look at their hands. What do you notice? The black woman's hands are empty. Right? And ads don't depend on you looking at them for more than a couple seconds, but always these messages of relationship, of status, of hierarchy. I think that picture speaks for itself. The Blind Side was a highly acclaimed Academy Award-winning film. Right. I was reading CNN, and you know those little sidebars pop up, and this one said most beautiful women from around the world, and representing South Africa, which is 92% black. And I should say not a single Asian woman in this spread. Asian women are the majority of all women on the planet, right? And I haven't used the word white supremacy yet, but I'm going to right now. For me, this is such a powerful illustration of white supremacy. White as superior, white as the norm for humanity, as the ideal person. That is the water that we swim in, and I think it's very descriptive. So how does race shape our lives? I'm going to use the example of my own life, and I'm confident that most white people in the room can relate to what I'm going to say, and no people of color can also say what I'm going to say. Right? So first of all, I was born into a society in which I belong. In virtually any situation deemed normal, neutral, or valuable, I belong. And I move through the world with a deeply internalized sense of it and expectation of it that I don't think about, but that is in my bones and my muscles and my posture and my worldview, what I care about, what I don't care about, right? I belong in that administration meeting. I belong at that church service, at that block party, dealing with my daughter's teachers, her camp counselors. I belong at that wedding. How many of you have been to a wedding? If it wasn't all white, it was pretty close. Okay, day in and day out, belonging. I don't carry that psychic burden of race. Represented in the government, we know what the presidency has looked like and will look like again. This is the House of Representatives. It's 83% white. And what I'm about to show you are images from the halls of power in this country. And where you see the yellow border around the picture, those are the people of color in this group. These are the U.S. senators. These are the leaders of the largest U.S. companies. This is the U.S. Supreme Court. U.S. governors. U.S. top military advisors, people who decide which TV shows we see, people who choose which movies get made, people with the most influence over which books we read. If you felt the weight of the teaching force, just keep adding, right? People who decide which music gets produced, people who decide which news is covered, owners of men's pro basketball teams, owners of men's pro football teams, owners of men's pro baseball teams, presidents of Ivy League universities. Institutionalized power and privilege. Now, you have to trust, you're just going to have to believe me that I'm not attached to the fact that this is a Republican. This picture just so captures what it means to be white. It does. It captures the world that I move in, right? The belonging, the networking, the opportunity, the segregation, right? The inclusion. The lack of a sense of loss, right? The separation. This is what it means to be white. And can you imagine the opportunity available to you if you intern for Paul Ryan? This is his incoming group of interns. I was raised Catholic. I don't know if there's a more powerful image than God. Even God is white, right? There's God creating man. There's Jesus and Mary, right? Constant messages that it's better to be white. I referred to this earlier when I said children absorb these messages. They don't miss them. Everything I'm showing you is meant to illustrate those messages, but I pulled from these because they surround us every day at the checkout counter. Here we have, under best hair, we have Halle Berry. Her hair is straightened. It's a really strong message to black women in particular. That's last year's world's most beautiful woman. Here is the sexiest man alive. Yes, this dude right here. And this year's world's most beautiful woman, right? White as the ideal for humanity. I was racially affirmed throughout my childhood, and I thought that I'll just capture it with that picture right there. No little girl misses the message. These are this year's top five runner-ups for Miss Teen USA. And yes, they are different girls. Whew, and I know they are, but I have to look really close. Okay. All right. Again, white as ideal. I'm wanting us to see that you can't miss internalizing this, and of course it's going to manifest when we get challenged. And just this is the group of the contestants. And as often happens, right, one, maybe two girls of color in the back or to the sides, right? This is what it means to be white. These are shows that I think many of us grew up with. I grew up with them. I think my daughter grew up with them. They take place across the decades. They're all about ideal friendship, right? So we have Seinfeld in the 80s, Sex and the City in the 90s, Friends in the 2000s, that's Gossip Girl, and there's Girls. Again, every one of these shows is about ideal friendship, and every one of these shows takes place in New York City. Arguably the most racially diverse city in the nation. And so the message, again and again, is even amongst diversity, there's no actual value in integration, in an integrated life, that this is the ideal life, even amongst diversity. Right? So I want to close this section by saying probably the most powerful way that my life has been shaped by my race is that I could be born into, and by the way, this picture was taken in Columbia City, right? Zip code 98118, formerly the most diverse neighborhood in Seattle. Okay, I could be born into, I could learn, I could play, I could worship, I could study, I could love, I could work, and I could die in racial segregation, and not one person who's ever loved me or mentored or taught me has ever conveyed to me that I've lost anything. I think this is the deepest message of all. This is the deepest message of those good neighborhoods we grow up in and those good schools we go to. Right? I want us to notice we call segregation good, right? We measure the value of our spaces by the absence of people of color. I know what a good school is. That's racial discourse. And I know what a good neighborhood is. And if I just follow the trajectory that my loving parents laid out for me, I could easily go to my grave without really knowing or having very many authentic, sustained cross-racial relationships. And again, no one suggested to me that I've lost anything. The fundamental message of segregation is that there's no inherent value in the perspectives or experiences of people of color. And that is a message that I couldn't help but internalize. But it's going to come out. It's going to come out now because I'm going to be sitting at the tables of power, the tables where decisions get made that affect other people's life. And I'm going to have a real hard time, one, noticing that other voices are missing or comprehending those voices if they fundamentally challenge my worldview. So if we go back and we think, what is kind of holding up new racism? What Eduardo Bonilla Silva, he's a sociologist who has a book whose title says it all, Racism Without Racists. We have racism, but nobody's racist anymore, right? So how do we do that? I think these are the foundations. The good, bad binary, to just make it an either or and exempt us if we see ourselves as open. deep implicit bias that we can't help but absorb. And it's not just once, right? It's 24/7 across our lives these messages are coming at us. This deep sense of ourselves as unique individuals outside of all this, right? Hey, if you just heard this part about my life, you'd know why I'm different from other white people, right? Universalism, the sense that we can represent everybody because we're unbiased. Internalized superiority, which again, you can't help but absorb. And on some level, investment in the racial order, often unconscious. So when I said it was a kind of willful not knowing, a refusal to know, I think that's rooted in this investment in a system that has served me and affirmed me so deeply. Now, I want you to know that that investment is not acceptable to me, and I've committed my life to challenging it, but just good intentions alone are not enough to do that, right? I cannot be complacent about it. And then the power of segregation to hold it all in place. This society is set up to reproduce racial inequality. It does it beautifully, and it's done it for a very, very long time. And all it depends on are white people being really nice and carrying on. You don't need to do anything. Just be, you know, smile at that coworker every now and then and go to lunch. Because niceness is not courageous. Niceness will not get racism on the table, and it won't keep it on the table when everybody wants to take it off the table. And I'm not saying don't be nice, because I guess it'd be better to be nice than not nice. But niceness is actually collusion, because it's not interrupting, right? All right, so we have this racial insulation, right, and internalized superiority, and it results in very common patterns, right? One of the challenges for us as white people, because we have such a sense of ourselves as individuals, is to be willing to go into that group place and look at the reality that there are very predictable patterns, because we're still swimming, regardless of what my personal narrative is, I'm still swimming in this water, and it still takes place in this water. Right? So we have patterns like this, preference for racial segregation and no sense of loss about that, a lack of understanding of what racism is, seeing ourselves as individuals outside of socialization, not understanding that we bring our history with us, assuming everyone is having our experience or could have our experience, arrogance, lack of humility, unwillingness to listen, dismissing what we don't understand, apathy towards racial injustice, wanting to jump over the hard personal work and get to solutions, confusing not agreeing with not understanding, right? I disagree. No, maybe I don't understand. Maybe I'm not in a position to agree or disagree. Needing to maintain white solidarity. White solidarity is the unspoken rule among whites that will keep each other comfortable around our racism, not challenge each other, and privilege our own feelings over racial injustice, basically. So needing to maintain that. Our highest priority being just saving face and looking good and having that be more important to us than actually interrupting racial injustice. Focusing on intentions over impact, and defensiveness about any connection to racism. And so when challenged, this white fragility emerges, right? I'm hoping I've painted a picture of what kind of sets us up, so and why we respond so poorly. And keep in mind that white fragility is not weakness per se, right? It's actually a very powerful means of everyday white racial control, right? As it leverages historical and institutional power to maintain our positions. It functions as a kind of bullying, to be honest. It's like, I'm going to make it so miserable for you to try to call me in on anything that I'm doing that you're just not going to do it anymore. And if I need to cry and be weak and get all the resources back to me as everybody comforts me, I'll do that. If I need to get my back up and, you know, get aggressive with you, I'll do that, right? So it's a kind of fragility in that I cannot handle the challenge, but it's not weak in that it's a very powerful way to stop, right, to stop the challenge.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum featuring Dr. Robin DiAngelo. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.